My name is Clancy Emmerslin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I've watched this group grow little by little over the years, and remember when it was first founded, and has come along, as most groups do. It's always been the theory of have a group that grows. Start on time, have good coffee, and have a speaker you can bear. And if you can do that, you'll go. But anyway, it's kind of a big anniversary time, I guess. Last night, I led the meeting of the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. Now, we've been going at it a long time. We celebrated our 42nd anniversary last night. And I'll tell you something more staggering than that. All the participants were the secretaries going back to 1963. That was really impressive, except some of them are dead. We didn't let them participate. But they said, who will we get? We said, I don't know, we'll dig somebody up. But it was a wonderful meeting. I mean, you know, you stop and think, you got up guys and girls, women, men, for over these years, and with very few exceptions, they still all attend the meeting, which is very unusual. And, of course, next week is Alcoholics Anonymous birthday on July 10th or June 10th, which is the anniversary of AA. And this is the fifth anniversary here, and I have the same birthday that Bob Darrell has, a little earlier. By the time 78 came, I was already jaded. But this has got an important time, and you know, we're at a time in AA's 70th birthday. It's kind of an important thing. It's rather important. AA is a big thing. It's the most important single help in the help of alcoholics like us. There's never been any treatment that has ever helped people like us in 5,000 years, except this one that stayed so long. But it is 70 years old. And I travel around quite a bit in AA, and I hear from time to time suggestions of how maybe we should update AA, make it a little bit different than the original was in 1935 or 38 when the book was written. And there falls in certain categories. There's a category that feels perhaps the day has gone by when we should confine ourselves to just having alcoholics in our meetings. That we should, because most of the young people today are taking narcotics as well as alcohol. There's a lot of narcotics addicts out there, and we act as though we're being kind of special by having to insist you be an alcoholic to be an AA. There's also a school of thought that talks a little bit about anonymity, whether or not anonymity is pretty well past its need. We don't have to be afraid to be known to be an AA. So many people have been known to be an AA. There's a school of thought that deals with the book. It's a good book. It's a fine book. But it's out of date. It's written in 1930s style. It isn't written in a modern style that would hold people's attention to come to AA now. And, of course, the last one that we hear about, I just ran across a pocket about this in Minneapolis, that the Lord's Prayer is really out of date. It's a Christian prayer. We should be... Laugh if you want, or they stop saying it. It isn't funny. And they're doing this all over the country and in all over the world. And they say the reason for it is because it's a Christian prayer and it keeps non-Christians out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it really is not very funny at all. And these things seem to be reasonable. And I want to just, on behalf of this anniversary, discuss them a little bit so we can think about what we're talking about. First of all, they say, why would you have to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous? What about the other people who need to be here? And that's always been a puzzle. And what you have to understand that, you have to go back to understand, well, I'll tell you what they say. Here's what they say. It's all one big disease. Alcoholism, narcotics addiction, gambling, eating. You know where that phrase came from? It came from a treatment center with only one van. Everybody into the truck, we're all going to AA tonight. But why would that be? Let me explain a little bit so maybe you can understand it. You have to go back to the nature of why we are here. Of all the alcoholics who come to AA, one of the things that most every one of us have had at one level or another inside of us after we're here for some time is, I know that this is a nice place, but my case is different. And they cannot stay. Bob talked about slipping again and again. I slipped for 10 years in and out of AA, the worst years of my life. And most people in this room seem to have slipped tonight by the raising of hands. Because why? Because my case is different. How do you get through to these people? There's information. There's written records of people of our type, alcoholics of our type, for 5,000 years who have been just an absolute conundrum to everyone who tried to help them. Because there seem to be types of alcoholics, really. They don't talk about it much, but there's a type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic. Something really drastic happens. They lose a job or a family or a death in the family, and they quit, and they never drink again. And we all know people like that. These other people who have become physically, these kind of people who have become physically addicted to Alcoholics Anonymous, to alcohol, and they must be medically withdrawn. They are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And each step of the way, they discover what's become of their lives, and they quit, and they never drink again. Up in Seattle, there's a hospital called Chic Chadel that has walls of successes of people that they've cured in 1 month, and they're all sober, and they truly are. But then there's another type of alcoholic, which seems we don't talk about much, but who seems to be an alcoholic by any measurement. And something drastic happens, they lose a job, or lose a family, a death in the family, and they're overcome by it, and they quit. But they always eventually begin to drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they mean it. I quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these are the people that have been such a puzzle to everybody for all these years. People have tried to help them, and doctors, and clergymen, and society. Just on and on and on and on. And they always eventually begin to drink again. And I'll tell you, you probably haven't seen much historical of it in your life, but if you, like me, you've seen it in your life. You've seen that look on someone who loves you, and that look of, oh my God, you've done it again. You promised you wouldn't. You were doing so well, and the children are starting to get better, and you're going to get your job back, and now you're drunk again. How could you do that? And I don't know the answer, so I say, shut up and leave me alone, because I don't know any answer to that. And that's the bafflement. You think, well, maybe that happens in some cases. Well, according to the National Institute of Health, now, AA is all over the United States, in every town with a stoplight, it's got an AA meeting, and we have big meetings a lot of places. The National Institute of Health, as of 2002, estimated that if alcoholics of our type in America, with all the help we're getting, with all the AA, it's estimated that about 95% of us still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. A lot of people in this room are going to die drunk. A lot of people are sober and doing good. I remember my sponsor told me that, and I thought, geez, recruiting talk. But some years later, when he drifted out of AA for a number of reasons and finally went to a psychiatrist who gave him some Vicodin who enabled him to drink till he drank himself to death and lay on the street, that put an exclamation point on that for me, I'll tell you. Now, what's a big deal about being an alcoholic? Because there's no shortage of information to help people like us. But people like me, and I presume like you, have a wall of armor up. Yeah. But you don't understand. You don't understand. And the only thing that has ever seemed to get through to us is find some way through that armor. But how do you get through that armor? I mean, I've had psychiatrists, you know, sure, give me some Thorazine, and I like my psychiatrist, but that's not an answer to any problem. The problem is, how do I get through that? And it turns out that the one thing that maybe can help is listening to someone who is talking about very things that you thought were only affecting you. The thing called identification. The thing that gets through that, where at least they may open up the armor a little bit and say, my God. I remember after all my slipping, and I was in a desperate state, and I'd just been thrown out of a skid row mission, and my front teeth were kicked out, and I couldn't think of a soul who would accept a collect phone call from me in the United States. And I fell into the hands of a guy who became my sponsor, and I thought he was a goof. But I thought he was rich, and I wanted him to subsidize my recovery because he was a movie actor. And I'll tell you, through a series of things that he told me and weathered me through a few things, I began to get the slightest trace of a feeling. I look back now, I never thought about it much at the time or thereafter, but I look back, the turning spot in my life was when I began to get the feeling, this guy seems to know how I feel. I had never known anybody who seemed to know how I feel. My father didn't. My bosses never did. My doctors never did. My clergy never did. But this guy seemed to know how I feel. Now you think, well, what's the big deal about that? I'll tell you the big deal about that. There isn't a person in this room that hasn't had enough advice to last him for 10,000 years. Passers-by, give a feeling of freedom. You know what you ought to do? Advice is nothing. But if you find someone who you can believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. And you may listen to it, and you may take actions that are stupid and seem stupid, you wouldn't do it. And those actions are what change your life. I remember that feeling, and I started doing things. But I almost quit because if you have a sponsor who's telling you about the steps, and AA, once he gets your attention, he has you do stupid things. Stupid things. Now, he doesn't ever say this, but it sounds like this. See that wall over there? That's bright red. That's gray, Bob. I tell you, it's bright red. Looks gray to me. Well, goddammit, you act like it's red. They don't tell you the color of walls, but they tell you things equally stupid. That woman, you called her a bitch. You apologize. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize.
Sorry.
Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. You stay on that job. But Jesus, Bob. They got me stuffing envelopes for $1.09 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this company, for God's sake. They're treating me like dirt. I don't care. You stay in that job till you get a better one. I understand you missed the Friday night meeting. Oh, Jesus, Bob. It's a big clique. They all suck around each other, and people like me are outside. They don't even call on me. I just treat me like dirt, Bob. They treat me like I'm a piece of crap, Bob. Well, maybe they know something. Go to the meeting. And this goes on and on and on and on. And one day you look at the damn wall and it's turned red. Then you have to spend the rest of your natural life dealing with dumbbells who think it's gray. What gets through? Identification that brings about action. Identification is that is why this organization, one other one ever was like this. In the 1840s, there was a group called the Washingtonians for 5 years. They grew much faster than they ever grew. They had 100,000 sober drunks after 5 years. And they had nobody ahead of them. So they thought, we're wasting our time trying to help drunks. We've helped all those. We should help all the other people who take narcotics, not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium. And we should help people who maybe stamp out the sale of alcohol. We should get involved in politics. And all these 100,000 people got involved in all of these things. And by 1848, the movement was extinct and they all died drunk. In fact, their experience helped you and me because in the 1940s, after AA had its big splurge through the Saturday Evening Post, we don't talk about it, but after a while, the meeting started to die out again. AA was dying out because they're fighting and beefing and problems and situations all over the country. Bill Wilson would sit in New York, get these letters. Our group died. Don't send us anymore. And finally, there's a new magazine called The Grapevine, and a guy in North Carolina sent him an article for the Grapevine, discussing the Washingtonians and what happened to him. And he saw that, and he'd never heard of the Washingtonians. And he looked it up, he realized, my God, we're going the way the Washingtonians are. We're going to be extinct. So in a desperate effort to save AA in 1945, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions. And they're based, the things we read tonight, and some people thought were funny, but they're not really funny at all. They're very, very serious. And the long form is hard to listen to them unless you know what you're listening to. But they really are, they deal with what wiped out the Washingtonians, and the observance of them is what saved AA. But the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is this, and the Washingtonians and the Alcoholics Anonymous, what do they have in common? One thing. They are the only successful treatments for alcoholics of our type in the history of mankind. Secondly, they are the only philosophies that consisted of one drunk talking to another drunk, because AA tonight in Las Vegas is really the same thing it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that is why a member of AA named Jim Willis, a good friend of mine, who was also a gambler, felt so bad he brought some gambler people to AA, but they didn't identify. So he got permission from AA in 1957 to use the 12 steps for the first time outside of AA, and he founded Gamblers Anonymous, which has become the most successful of all the non-AA movements. A couple of years later, two guys I knew got permission to use the 12 steps for narcotics addicts. Then they used them for cocaine. They used them for food. And these flourishing in varying regards. Now, why did they get these things? So people would have a place to go and identify, not just hear that there's an answer, and that may be nice, but it doesn't fit me because I don't identify with the problem. You have to identify with the problem to accept the answer. I really got a very great insight of that in 1960. I was about 2 years sober, still had no front teeth, but I'd learned to carry my lip like this. People thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I was at the AA club one night at a little meeting, and I gave a little talk on obsessions that was just wonderful. I mean, because I know a lot about obsessions, not about the answer to them, just the obsessions themselves. And some woman came up after, she said, "Oh, that was just wonderful. We have a new organization around the corner called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come over Sunday and talk to our ladies?" I said, "Sure." I weighed about 130 pounds and... And I went over to that church on Olympic on Sunday. There's about 8 fat women sitting around the table. And I gave them a great talk on obsessions. They're all... And they got done, and I knew I'd helped them. Then they had a little sharing session, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Woman over here, she had a son who just had a birthday. He was going to a military school in Long Beach. She made a lovely cake for him. She sent the husband down to pick him up in Long Beach. She tasted the cake to see what it tasted like. And another taste. And by the time he got back, the whole cake was gone. I thought, Jesus. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I just have a piece of cake for Christ's sake. Woman over here talked about eating ice cream. Should I just eat ice cream? I go down and get some more and more. And I didn't say anything because I'm a nice guy. But I wanted to say, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Over here, a woman talked about how she ate so much that she couldn't eat anymore. Went to the toilet, put her fingers down her throat, puked it up, and ate some more. And I didn't say anything because I'm a nice guy, but I wanted to say, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it a lot for drinking. Oh, it's only Saturday afternoon, the sun's still up, shit, I'm drunk. Now, what was the difference? I knew exactly what they were saying. I didn't identify. It just became pointless information. And that's why you have a hard time explaining to your family, no matter how much they love you, what alcoholics are. Don't expect them to know. They have no frame of reference in which to put it. They'll try to, many of them try to support you. Many of them say, but certainly you can have wine at Christmas. But they're not being rude because they know anybody else could. Why can't you? But they don't understand the nature of the beast. But that is why it seems to me that we have to remember that we use alcoholics to communicate in AA, not because they're better than any other thing or worse than anything else, But I now, for example, I have three daughters turning 16 this year in AA. One just turned 16. I have a grandson who's a year sober. I have a great-grandson who's 3 years old, who is either an alcoholic or the spawn of the devil. Every time I see him, I look at the back of his neck to see if there's a 666 there. But if he be alcoholic, I hope when he comes to rooms like this, he will hear people talk about things he identify with, not some glib gobbledygook from a counselor or from somebody who's got a problem entirely different, where he says, no, that's not me, and goes out and dies. That's how people die around here. They don't learn why they should stay. So the greatest thing, despite modern day, whatever it might be, and I think it's imperative that we must remember, you must be an alcoholic to be a functioning member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can be an alcoholic and an addict, an alcoholic and a gambler, an alcoholic and an overeater. You can twist baby chickens' necks for all we care. But you got to be an alcoholic, and you should talk about it when you talk in AA. Talk about alcoholics so the listener out there will say, oh, my God, I understand that. That is why we have to do it. Then there's some talk these days about anonymity, kind of no longer needed. We don't need anonymity. People aren't ashamed to be an alcoholic. Maybe 1935, 1940, people are going around hiding. We don't have to be that way anymore. But that's not the purpose of it. That's the way it started out, but it evolved into something entirely different. You know, when I first came into AA in 1958, Halloween 1958, 20 years before you came around, nice to see you newer people staying active. But when I came into AA then, there was right in the middle of a controversy because a woman named Lillian Roth had just written a book called I'll Cry Tomorrow. She was a famous singer, and she gave a big push in there to her membership in AA. They said, you shouldn't do that, Lillian. She said, oh, no, I think it'll help people want to come now that they know that a famous person like me is in AA. And a couple years later, when she was laying face down drunk in Palm Springs and throwing up her pills, I don't know what effect that had in AA, but it certainly destroyed her. Remember the next year after that, John Barrymore's daughter, because I had all these things branded out of my head in my early sobriety. She wrote a book called Too Much Too Soon, in which she thanked AA. AA had helped her so much that she was able to have wine with dinner now. She was really doing good. And when she drank, when she got drunk in a cell in Malibu, nobody paid much attention. But over the years, I watched person after person break their anonymity for whatever their good motives are. I've never seen one profit from it. Bad things seem to happen to him. Why? Why would that be? And I think the reason is because there's a spiritual concept involved here that nobody thinks about much. And as far as I can see, the spiritual concept is this, that as long as I sublimate my ego and my pride to AA and maintain anonymity and just be one of the troops, I'm being helped by AA. If I go publicly and say, look, I'm a big shot. I am now helping AA by telling you that I belong to that organization. I've now changed the roles. I'm now helping AA. And something bad happens after that. I've never seen anyone profit from that. I remember 1972, most of you won't remember that. The presidential candidate was an alcoholic, anonymous member. And his candidates were going so bad, he finally said down in Texas, I'm an AA member. And after that, it got really bad for him. And I was glad. I'd hate to think of some alcoholic with his thumb on the red button. That son of a bitch looked at me funny. In fact, the last letter Bill Wilson wrote, the last letter he wrote, dealt with anonymity. He said, we must maintain anonymity, not to preserve ourselves, but of its spiritual context. It's a spiritual entity. We surrender ourselves. Most people believe that in understanding, but they don't quite understand what is meant by anonymity. For example, I just got up here and gave my last name. Isn't that breaking my anonymity? I'll tell you what anonymity is. Because of the nature of my work and because I'm a recovered alcoholic, I get interviewed a lot in the Los Angeles Times and on television in Los Angeles. There's been an article about me in the Reader's Digest, quite well known. Now they say, well, you're breaking your anonymity. No, I'm not. Because I'm listed as a recovered alcoholic, which I am to them. But But once I ever say that I'm a member of AA or a part of AA, you may no longer use my name. You must no longer use my picture. I don't know if any of you saw that program 5 years ago A&E did on Alcoholics Anonymous. Great hour-long program where they had four AAs from around the country who talked about AA. I was the one for the West Coast. Perhaps now you remember me. Yeah. But anonymity is when I associate myself publicly with AA. Dr. Bob, now, he believed very much in anonymity. I'll tell you something else he believed. You hear sometimes, my name is Jim R. Dr. Bob felt that it was as much of a violation of the traditions to maintain your anonymity within AA as it was to break it without AA. We're not trying to protect ourselves from each other. We're not here to, don't know who I am. Give me a call if you're in trouble. My name is Fred. You know. But anonymity itself, the spiritual condition of it is absolutely imperative. It has nothing to do with protecting ourselves. It's something to do with the subjugation of our own ego to something more important than we are. And they always talk about the book. Well, the book's a nice book, but it really is kind of stilted. And tonight a new person here is going to get a book in the countdown. I put a little something in it that said it doesn't seem like much at first, and that's the way I found it. When I first came to AA in the late 1940s, my sponsor had me read the book, and I'm a writer. I became a writer by profession, and they'll say it's a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. It's just a dull book. Just a dull book. And you read it, I just found it terribly dull. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row and went back to AA, my new sponsor had me read the book. And you know what I found out this time? An endlessly dull book. I wrote advertising, successful advertising. Do this, buy this product, take this action, let's go. And you read that book and it never, nothing. So, if you are thorough at this stage of your development, you'll be. I just had to give up on the book. I mean, it helps some people, not me. And I got this wicked sponsor who I later found out was using it to teach me. And the greatest thing about the big book is this. It gets smarter every year. If you can get through the first year without it, then it gets really, makes a turn for the better. It's a remarkable book. And they say, this book is a miracle. Now, the word miracle is misused a lot in AA especially. Everything's a miracle. A few years ago, I heard a guy say, I got up early this morning, and I looked at the eastern sky, and the sun was coming up. And I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of living sober. Oh, Jesus. You feel like saying, get up early tomorrow and have another one, you idiot. Yeah. Miracles are supposed to be non-explainable. Inexplicable is the word exactly. You can't explain it. Now, why would they consider this book to be a miracle? Well, one thing, the guy that wrote it didn't know enough to write it. He was 3 years sober. He was surrounded by people, most of whom were getting drunk. Very few of the people stayed sober. The first printing the book, the stories in the back, most of those guys died drunk. Because they didn't, not because they were bad guys, they didn't know they had to keep doing it. That's all. But anyway, he was surrounded by failures and losses and troubles, and he had no background in psychology or abnormal psychology. Some of the people staying sober, trying to put down what they were doing and didn't understand it. And he wrote this book. Now, if you're new tonight, you might think, man, sober 3 years. He should know enough to write a book by then. Oh. I'm going to tell you something. If you last 3 years, you'll discover you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're sober 5 years, you just try to be kind to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy. You're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two creams and one sugar or two sugars and one cream? Oh, never mind, for Christ's sake. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Th- 3 years sober ain't that much. But this guy wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 66 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That's a miracle. And they said, okay, it's a good book, and it's a miracle, but maybe we should change it. And why not? You know, it's kind of stilted in its language sometimes. And I'll tell you why. Because it is not written as a book of information. We think it is, but it isn't. The big book is really, I mean, today we see people, there's a cult in AA who study the big book and write sentences about it. And this word means this, and Christ, it's just obsessive. Now, they're entitled to do that. But I'll tell you what the big book actually is, according to its author and according to all early AAs. This book is more like a cookbook. It has recipes in it for you, for action to take. Just like a cookbook. If you sit and study a cookbook for 2 weeks and memorize every part of it, you'll starve. You gotta cook the damn things. And to know all about why you should help newcomers isn't anywhere near as important as helping a newcomer. Giving a guy a ride home is more important than being able to recite the book from beginning to end. Because this is what it's about. It deals with emotions. And I'll tell you something. It may seem a little stilted, but emotions haven't changed since 1939 to now. Emotions haven't changed since for the last 10,000 years. They write about emotions in the time of the pharaohs, the same emotions you and I have. Maybe different reasons. You know, when Pharaoh noticed his rivers running with blood, he was furious. When I get cut off in the freeway, I'm furious. You bitch, what are you doing up there? No. Hope I don't have my Easy Does It sticker on this car. But what all of Alcoholics Anonymous is about is learning to deal with emotions that kill people like us. Because when the emotions get bad enough, we drink. And that's how we stop it. That there's a hope that you won't have to go through it. So I think it's probably a good idea to keep the book. These people want to change the book. Most of them don't have very long sobriety. They want to base it on what they learned in some treatment center, what their counselor told them, or what their bartender told them. We don't care. This is the only thing that has worked. You will show me something that works better, and we'll change it. But not till you show me something that works better, baby. You're trying to get me to stop, aren't you? Not for a long time. The comic may be out here having his mic over there. Hey. One other thing that's really sensitive today in AA, really sensitive, medications. And all over the country, people fight and argue and beef about that. If you suggest that maybe they shouldn't take medications, you're not a doctor. Who are you to tell me what to do? And it really is a very, very sensitive thing. And I want to I want to tell you this. I am not advocating anyone to stop taking their medications, their antidepressants, whatever it may be. That is not my job. I'm not a doctor. I'm just here to tell you a little bit about it. You know, it's a funny thing. It's kind of an odd thing, is that a few years ago they found a strong antidepressant, several of them, that seemed to fit bipolarism. And within the next 5 years, the greatest epidemic ever seen in America, every third person became a bipolar victim. I guess I've got it, doctor. And I guess there are a few bipolar cases, but they're not anywhere near as many as they are. I'll tell you why people think they're bipolar here and need medication. It's because the symptoms here are as the symptoms of being bipolar, or as they used to say before, they called it bipolar, they called it manic depression, highs and lows. The symptoms of early sobriety are highs and lows. Oh, I found a wonderful new program. Oh, Jesus Christ, I'm going to kill myself. Oh, And it even looks to doctors like manic depression, but it is not. It is the symptoms of withdrawing from a continual depressant called alcohol. And the purpose of AA and its actions are to cut down these swings. That's what AA is about. It isn't to make you sober longer and longer. It's to cut down these swings, because you won't stay sober unless you cut them down. And these steps do it. The steps make the wall turn color. That's what it does. There's no intellectual understanding for it, but it does. And when your perception of things change, things look different. You say, but what do I do about that? Next year, it won't look anywhere near as bad as it does today. And you'll see it differently. I remember when I was 5 years sober, I was pleased. I was finally able to buy a tombstone for my son's grave that I hadn't been able to think about for years, because I was drunk in jail when he died, and I could never forgive myself. When I thought about it, I became suicidal. But after a while, I realized that wasn't me that did that. That was a poor idiot who didn't know any better, a drunken fool, who, like a drunken relative almost. That was me before I discovered what the colors really were. So there's no sense beating yourself over it. It's just you have to learn to live with it. And so now people say, but you need medication. I am not saying you shouldn't. I don't tell people I can't take medication, but I'll tell you one thing, where much of the medication comes from. Today, most of the treatment centers in America load up their patients with antidepressants. And they hit the street loaded with antidepressants. But antidepressants are designed for short-term use. Long-term use, they become lethal. They create terrible depressions. You read in the paper, teenage suicides, adult homicides from extended use of safe antidepressants. So why not just use the antidepressants and get off them? Because people like us become addicted to them. But they say they're not addictive. Everything is addictive to me that changes my perception. Alcohol is not addictive, but you tell that to an alcoholic dying on the street. And so when people come to me and our group, we tell them that, you know, we think probably you are not, what you're doing with these antidepressants, you are disguising the symptoms, that's all. They're still there. It's like having an ulcerated tooth and taking some Novocaine saying it's no longer there. The problem is still there. And what do we say? I go to take people and say, I don't want you to get off them, because I'll tell you, if you want to see something lethal, watch people get off an addiction to antidepressants. It's like getting them off heroin, for Christ's sake. It's just terrible. So I go to their doctors and we say, can we find a way to wean you off just a little bit over a period of time, like you would off any other addictive drug? And a lot of them do. But a lot of them say, no, you don't understand. My case is different. I need these things. And bad things happen to them down the road. So I'm not telling you not to take them. And I'm not saying that perhaps you're not bipolar. Maybe you are. Maybe you're one of the few rare cases of being truly bipolar. But there certainly aren't two-thirds of AA are not bipolar. And that's about how many people are on antidepressants now around the country. And it's a sad thing. And what you and I have to do is remember that AA is not designed to get you off alcohol. It's designed to teach you to live in reality. That means you get rid of alcohol or anything else. But as I say, I'm not telling you to get off. I'd want some irate person. How dare you tell me to get off these medications? I'm not telling you to get off them. I'm just telling you that the long-term effects are lethal. And I hope that we will always at least notify people on them that this is the case. You don't have to get off them. You can take them as long as you want it. Better you than me, pal. But I'm just telling you that seems to me we should communicate to people who don't yet know how lethal they are and what they do. The last thing that people talk about a lot in AA is the Lord's Prayer. And they just had a big, big fight in Minneapolis recently about taking the Lord's Prayer. And around some countries, they don't even say the Lord's Prayer, because it's that damn religious prayer. We don't say religious prayers. We say the Serenity Prayer. And it's really ironic. Bob and I were talking about it on the way over here. If you ever want to see something religious, see the prayer from which the Serenity Prayer was excerpted in the middle. It's all about sin and God and Jesus, and really, it makes you almost want to shape up. Not quite, but I mean it does. And that is a Christian prayer. What's in the Lord's Prayer? They say that's a Christian prayer, given by a rabbi to 12 followers who were Jews. Here, you Jews, here's a prayer. But this is a Christian prayer. No, it isn't. It's a Jewish prayer. Yeah. A good example of, you know, people say, well, it'll keep the Jewish people out. No, it won't. Our meeting in Los Angeles is in a synagogue like this. We have a membership of about 1,000 in our meeting every Wednesday night. So many of you have been there. Sometimes the rabbi comes in and sits in the back trying to figure out how to get that many people into his synagogue on Friday night. But I always notice when we say the Lord's Prayer, he jumps up and says the Lord's Prayer. It doesn't offend a rabbi, but it offends some neurotic just out of Al's 12th step house. I found a letter that is really quite good, written by Bill Wilson in 1959, talking about where the Lord's Prayer came from. Listen to this, kind of interesting. Now about the business of adding the Lord's Prayer to each AA meeting. This practice probably came from the Oxford groups who were influential in the early days of AA. You have probably noted in AA Comes of Age what the connection of these people with AA really was. I think saying the Lord's Prayer was a custom of theirs following the close of each meeting. Therefore, it has quite easily got shifted into a general usage among us. Of course, there are always those who seem to be offended by the introduction of any prayer, whatever, into an ordinary AA gathering. Also, it is sometimes complained that the Lord's Prayer is a Christian document. Nevertheless, this prayer is of such widespread use and recognition that the argument of its Christian origin seems to be a little far-fetched. It is also true that AAs believe in some sort of God and that communication and strength is obtainable through his grace. No question about that. Since this is the general consensus, it seems only right that at least the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer be used in connection with our meetings. It does not seem necessary to defer to the feelings of our agnostic and atheist friends, newcomers to the extent of completely hiding our light under a bushel. However, around here, the leader of the meeting usually asks those to join him in the Lord's Prayer who feel they would care to do so. The worst that happens to the objectors is they have to listen to it. This is doubtless a salutary exercise in tolerance at their stage of progress. So that's the sum of the Lord's Prayer business as I recall it. Your letter made me wonder what it was all about. But that's it's so ridiculous because we all have little fights. We have little fights in AA about dumb little things, and the Lord's Prayer is one of them. And I read the Lord's Prayer, and I don't see anything in the Lord's Prayer that does not come from almost from the 12 steps, parts of that prayer, everywhere in the 12 steps. And to take the Serenity Prayer out of its religious prayer so it won't be offensive is for me to take part of the Lord's Prayer and just use that. Well, tonight we'll say, give us this day our daily bread. Amen. <Yeah. laughs> Doesn't offend anybody. Doesn't mean anything. So really, when you think about it now, we're AA 70 years old. I'm probably the only one in the room that remembers when it began. I want to tell you something sad about being in your 70s. I was talking to the guy in the L.A. airport. We were sitting there talking, and he was about 80, and he'd been in the Navy, and I'd been in the Navy. Somehow we got talking, and we were joking about taking, what's the stuff they used to put in there? Huh?
Viagra.
No, stuff they used to... Viagra. Huh? What's the stuff they used to put in our food to keep us from being?
Saltpeter.
Yeah. Viagra. I'll tell you, I start taking iron tablets when I turned 70. They wanted me to take iron tablets, and I took them for a lot of years. And about 3 months ago, I tried a Viagra. And I did not know if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours, I face north. But yeah. On the other hand, let me say this: we're talking about taking saltpeter. I know these in the Second World War, when I was on ships, they put a lot of saltpeter through it. We didn't know that, but it's to keep you from being sexed up. so you won't eye the messman or... You know, you just... And it never worked with me. I was always restless and irritable and just always wanted to find somebody to help. And the damn thing about that saltpeter, it just kicked in about 2 years ago. Enough of that. Today, 7 years old, and I think maybe, hopefully if you're new, you understand why we ask you to be an alcoholic, to be an Alcoholics Anonymous member, because we must communicate, get through that wall of defiance and difference. And that's why we ask you to remain anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films. Not because we're against being alcoholic, but so that we remember to sublimate our ego to the ultimate good of all. And that's why we want to keep this book as it is, because it has worked. And I don't know, I would hate to change it. They changed the stories in the back. They just did that last year. But those first 164 pages have been the only series of recipes that have kept people like us alive. So I think maybe until we find something better that's proven, we'll try that. And I think the idea of changing the book is just probably not a very effective one at all. And you must remember, be very careful. Antidepressants are so inviting. Oh, yes, they're safe. They won't come in. And you'll change. And now I don't have to. And all of a sudden, you're gone. That's what happened to my sponsor. That's how I know it so well. And finally, the Lord's Prayer is a... It's not, if you're an atheist or agnostic, no big deal. You just say it. Who cares what you feel? You just do it. You just do it. And that helps you one day turn around and look at that damn wall turn red. And when that day comes, it's worth all it took. Thank you.